We'd been to a bus stop, where a plus-sized 12-year-old had wiped out on a skateboard, and we'd been to the home of a schizophrenic teenager in a Def Leppard jersey who said she felt like someone invisible was choking her. Though I'd practiced my new skill set by controlling bleeding, administering oxygen, strapping on a spinal collar, and attaching EKG leads, the experience exposed me more to human nature and suffering than to stress and adrenaline. "What's your dream call?" Francisco turned and asked when we drove away from the hospital after dropping off an elderly man who'd passed out in his bathroom and defecated all over himself. "It would be amazing to deliver a baby," I said. "I've done that a couple of times, but my dream call is a bus full of Hawaiian tropic girls crashes, and I have to triage all of them." On most of the remaining calls that shift, we learned that the Rolling Stones were right when they sang, "What a drag it is getting old." Thanks to the miracle of modern medicine, the suffering, humiliation, and loneliness of a human being can now be extended for years. And perhaps that's how it's supposed to be. In my EMT class on delivering babies, as if I needed any more evidence for my Fliesian beliefs, I'd learned that one way to make sure a newborn is healthy is to see if it's grimacing. If we come into this world smiling, something is wrong with us, so we might as well leave life just as miserable as we enter it. This may sound cynical, but all the talk I'd heard of apocalypse, war, murder, cannibalism, and genocide over the last few years was starting to get to me. It's hard to be optimistic when you know you're going to die. Though I enjoyed speeding through the city's backsides to find people who needed our help, all I really learned from the experience was that living to the end of my lifespan, 77.8 years for the average American, will be a lot more pleasant if I'm surrounded by people who love me than if I'm alone. So, in addition to fitness and health, I'd have to add family to my survival stockpile. Though, unlike my other supplies, it probably wouldn't be a good idea to have one set in Los Angeles and another in St. Kitts. On the way to class one night, I saw a motorcycle lying on the shoulder of the highway with a man slumped next to it. Every car blew past, paying him no attention. I pulled onto the shoulder, unzipped my bug-out bag, grabbed the emergency first aid kit, and raced to his side. He wasn't badly hurt, so I pressed a 2x4-inch piece of gauze against his arm to stop the bleeding, then secured the gauze with a roller bandage while waiting for the paramedics. Something in me was beginning to change. I'd never stopped to help a stranger before. I always assumed someone else would do it, and better than I could. Despite this, I still lacked the stress inoculation I needed. Maybe I'd just chosen the wrong ambulance crew to ride with. So, before our final EMT skills exam, I asked the guy who sat in front of me how to join his search and rescue team. Maybe with them I'd get the experience I needed. Later that week, I finally received the email I'd been waiting over a year and a half for. "Your application for citizenship has been approved," Maxwell wrote, "and we are now submitting your title document to the Ministry of Finance in order to obtain your citizenship certificate and subsequently your passport." I couldn't believe it had finally happened. Tears of relief rushed to my eyes. If he was to be believed, and this wasn't just another stalling tactic, the backup plan I'd set in motion well over a year ago was nearly complete. I was almost a citizen of St. Kitts. Lesson 52. Murder Scene Manners. If any police officer ever gives you flack, get his name, then come to me. Detective Mike Vesperman, head of the Devonshire Police Homicide Division, was speaking in the roll call room. It was my first time inside a police station. I always imagined I'd be entering in handcuffs, not as a potential reserve officer. "As far as I'm concerned," he continued, "when you're out there, you have the same status and respect as any police officer working the scene. I have tremendous respect for what your team does." The team was the search and rescue unit I'd asked my EMT classmate about, California Emergency Mobile Patrol, or CEMP, a 46-year-old nonprofit on call around the clock for the Los Angeles Police Department and the Los Angeles Fire Department. As instructed by the team's applicant coordinator, I was wearing a white button-down shirt, black pants, and black boots. At the end of the meeting, I had to present my case to the group and then either be accepted or rejected as an applicant. Vesperman was telling us about a body he'd found the previous week. It belonged to an artist who toured Europe with his work, but lived as a vagrant in the park because he didn't like confined spaces. A few days earlier, he'd bought beer for some teenagers. An argument ensued. He called one of their girlfriends a bitch, and the guys returned later and stabbed him. It was one of the most violent stabbings Vesperman said he'd seen. To determine the date of death, a maggot was removed from the body and sent to the coroner's office, where an insect expert pinpointed the murder time based on the life cycle of the larvae. Vesperman wiped a hand across his brow. He was thin and bald, with taut skin and small, serious eyes that had seen the extremes of man's inhumanity. He'd been a homicide detective for over a quarter century, as had his father. If learning wilderness survival had thickened my skin, joining CEMP would certainly harden what lay beneath. Beyond the exposure to stress and violence, there were survival advantages I hadn't anticipated. Dozens of hours of rescue and police training, relationships with fire chiefs, police captains, and park rangers, field trips to the 911 call center, the coroner's office, and the rest of the city's emergency nerve center, police blue uniforms, shiny metal badges, police radios, and cars with flashing lights and sirens that would get me past official roadblocks much better than my CERT uniform, and access to the government's wireless priority service program, which would give my cell phone precedence over other calls during an emergency when the network was tied up. Even Spencer couldn't buy all that. Three nights before, CEMP had helped Vesperman secure a crime scene. In this case, a 15-year-old girl had told her 18-year-old brother she'd found a rifle buried in the park. She led him to the spot and showed him where to dig for it. But there was no gun. Unbeknownst to him, he was digging his own grave. When it was deep enough, his sister began stabbing him in the back. "What are you doing?" he cried out. "I'm your brother. I love you." Suddenly, she had a change of heart, stopped, and called 911. He was brought to the hospital in critical condition. When asked why she'd done it, she simply told the police it was time for him to die. "Human beings are animals," Vesperman told us, scanning the room. "They're vicious animals. Some of the things I've seen them do, I could never even have imagined before I started this job. I thought my outlook on human nature was dark when I began learning survival, but the people I'd met along the way were far more flighty than I was, and they were in surprisingly good company. No less an authority on human nature than Sigmund Freud believes something similar. I have found little that is good about human beings on the whole," Freud once confessed in an interview. "In my experience, most of them are trash. No matter whether they publicly subscribe to this or that ethical doctrine, or none at all." Vesperman spent the next half hour teaching newer members of the group how to preserve a murder scene. He told us not to touch the victims, not to cover them with a blanket or sheet, not to outline their bodies in chalk, despite what we'd seen in movies, not to smoke, spit, or chew tobacco at the scene, and not to let anyone touch cigarette butts, bloodstains, or drag marks. All these things will contaminate DNA evidence and give the defense lawyer an opening to create doubt in the minds of jurors. "These rules," Vesperman continued, "were especially important since in a few months the state of California planned to begin taking DNA samples from every person arrested within its borders." I looked around the room after Vesperman said this, but no one else seemed disturbed. The official reason for inserting radio frequency identification chips in passports and putting cameras on street corners and creating databases of people's DNA, facial features, fingerprints, and irises is to aid investigators and to reduce crime and terrorism. But these measures come with an uncomfortable potential for abuse. At the press of a button, a government could turn these surveillance tools against its own citizens in ways that would make fascist regimes of the past seem permissive in comparison, Anonymity is a dying art. I look at every murder the same way, Vesperman was concluding. Whether it's a celebrity or a vagrant, they're still someone's son or daughter. When the meeting ended, I was interviewed by the team about why I wanted to be a member and the skills I had. After I told them about everything I'd been learning and the hands-on disaster experience I was seeking, they went silent. Am I in? I asked. We'll let you know. Their words traveled into my ear, formed a lump in my throat, and stopped in a knot in my chest. I had no idea if I was the kind of person they were looking for, and I wanted, more than anything, to be part of the team. Not just for the experience, uniform, and siren. I wanted to belong. Before entering the roll call room of the Devonshire police station that day, I was alone and adrift in a world of panicked people. But in that room, there was a community of skilled men and women with a sense of purpose and mission. Unlike the paranoid PTs and the stockpiling survivalists, these were people who weren't just trying to save their own lives. They had the resources, they understood the system, they knew the authorities, and they possessed not just the skills, but the heart to help others survive in the cruel world Vesperman had described. I walked to the police officer's break room to await the team's decision. Above the snack machine, world's wildest police videos flickered on a small television set. A few minutes later, the applicant coordinator, SR-77, no one here used names, only numbers, appeared in the doorway. "Welcome to the team," she said. "I don't know why they just didn't tell you on the spot instead of making you suffer like that." I broke into a wide, relieved smile. Up until now, I'd sponged knowledge wherever I could find it. This was the first time I'd felt like part of something. When I returned to the roll call room, I was briefed on my responsibilities, a long list of team rules, and the minimum hours I was expected to put in every month. In an emergency like an earthquake, your first priority is the safety of your family, SR-33, the team's medical officer, sternly informed me. When that's taken care of, your next priority is the safety of your neighborhood. After that, your next priority is CEMP. I didn't realize it until that moment, but this wasn't just a survival training decision. It was a life decision. As of that evening, I was no longer Neil to these people. I was an alphanumeric sequence. I was SR-14A. But rather than feeling like I'd lost my individuality, I felt like I'd gained a network. Lesson 53. How to listen to the Earth's crust. It wasn't long after joining CEMP that I experienced my first natural disaster. Since being accepted as an applicant, which entailed 6 months of training, followed by a 3-month probationary period, I'd bought my first ham radio. When the shit hits the fan, if both land and mobile lines went completely dead, I'd need some way to connect to the outside world to find out what was going on, what areas were safe, and if necessary, call for help. Katie didn't like the radio, especially when I left it on the earthquake channel. The station was completely silent because it was hooked up to a machine that detected seismic activity. If it started emitting tones, this meant the machine was picking up tremors, and anyone listening should immediately duck, cover, and hold. "It's like another presence in the room I can't see," Katie complained. "What if we're sleeping at night, and the static comes on, and all of a sudden we hear a creepy voice saying, 'I'm watching you'?" I laughed. I actually thought she was kidding. My mistake. "You probably think it's totally unrealistic, but honey, it could totally happen. It's scary." "Have you ever realized how much your life has suffered because of your fears?" I asked her. I needed to do something to help Katie. If she continued like this, she'd end up as a crazy old spinster sealed in a house full of cats. Except she wouldn't even have cats to keep her company, because she'd be afraid they'd sit on her chest and steal her breath while she slept. "You're always fighting with your sister because she resents driving you everywhere, and you're constantly canceling plans and job interviews because you can't drive anywhere by yourself." "I guess you're right about that." She took off her reading glasses and put down The Fear Book by Sherry Huber, which I'd bought in an attempt to help her. I would take a taxi, but I don't trust taxi drivers. The book clearly wasn't working. Or you could take driving lessons, I suggested. I don't know. I'm scared I'm going to turn the wheels the wrong way and hit things, and I'm worried about other drivers crashing into me. That's why you need to learn about a car before driving it. In order to engage in life fully, we sometimes have to subject ourselves to small, calculated risks. And though we can't control anyone else's behavior, we can learn to control ours to minimize those risks. I couldn't believe the words coming out of my mouth. Somehow, during all this, I'd actually stopped acting like a whiny, clinging child and grown up. When it came to driving lessons, Katie resisted for a couple of days, but when her sister forgot to pick her up one afternoon and she missed an interview for a job she wanted at a television production company, she relented and agreed to face her fear. The following afternoon, an elderly Hispanic man with a white beard picked her up for her first driving lesson. Katie peered into the car, then turned to me. "I trust him," she said. "He reminds me of Lola." Lola was our goat. She'd arrived earlier that week, affectionate, curious, and very pregnant. Katie had named her Lola after the show tune lyric, "Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets." "She's a pretty little goat, and we will spoil her like we never spoiled Betty," she explained. While Katie wreaked havoc on the streets of Los Angeles, I drove to Santa Ana and took my FCC technician class exam, which enabled me to receive an amateur radio license, a call sign, and authorization to broadcast on ham radio. The day after my license was granted, I was home alone with the radio on the Earthquake channel while Katie was taking another driving class. Suddenly, a warbling pitch emerged from the speaker. I dove under a desk in the room and gripped its sides. As I did, the house began to shake as if a giant hand had taken hold of it and was rocking it more solidly into its foundation. Then it stopped. Its magnitude was 5.4 on the Richter scale. No one was hurt. Nothing fell off the shelves, but it was humbling nonetheless. I thought of the analogy I'd heard so much from environmentalists, that we were fleas on the back of the earth, which was itching to get us off. Since I was safe, I called Katie to make sure she was all right. Then I walked outside to check on Lola and ensure the neighborhood was secure. Next, I called CEMP and asked if they needed me. It felt good to know what to do. Lesson 54. Where to swim across the border. It was a minor miracle. Katie was actually driving me to the UPS store, where I needed to get fingerprinted for my EMT license. She was self-conscious behind the wheel, hesitant about controlling an object much heavier and more powerful than her, but she had done it. On her third try, she'd passed her driving test and received a license. "I feel like my entire life has changed," she gushed. In the last week, she'd re-enrolled in school and driven herself to half a dozen job interviews. "Now, instead of having to depend on everyone, I can depend on myself. It's like freedom." She paused to make a wide, sloppy turn onto Ventura Boulevard, then continued. "It's weird, though. When someone wants me to meet them somewhere, my first reaction is to get stressed out and think, 'Fuck, I can't.'" "So what do you do to get over that?" I asked. "I just get in the car and drive," she said, as if the solution had been that simple all along. "But why are you able to do that now when you couldn't before?" "Because now that I've had more practice driving, I'm confident," she answered as she careened over a speed bump and landed with a thump in the parking lot. "I trust myself now." Funny, I thought. That's exactly how I felt after practicing the survival skills I'd learned, though hopefully I was a better survivalist than she was a driver. At the UPS store, I watched as a college student wearing white gloves rolled my fingers one by one onto the scanner of a computer. I watched as my fingerprints appeared one by one on the screen, and I watched as he clicked on the submit button. Within seconds, my fingerprints were on file with the United States Department of Justice forever. They now had identifying information I couldn't simply change with a new document. "You're on their records now," the student said afterward. Even he knew I'd just done something irreversible. I guess I'd made a choice that afternoon. For perhaps the first time, my fight instinct had beaten my flight instinct. Besides, I now had the skills to sneak across the border anyway. I'd even talked to my new law enforcement friends and learned that the best place to make my getaway was across the Rio Grande near McAllen, Texas, which currently wasn't patrolled by boat between midnight and 8 a.m. Paranoia may not pay, but it does sometimes require payment, and that payment comes in the form of reassurance. As for the privacy I had to sacrifice, like Katie overcoming her driving phobia, I learned that doing what I feared didn't make my concerns any less valid, but it did destroy the immobilizing power they held over me. So since my prints were now on file, there was no longer any harm in applying for the concealed weapons permit I'd studied for at gunsight, or taking a shooting test to get a permit to carry a firearm openly in California, or taking a written test to get licensed as a security guard. If anyone was in trouble, they were definitely going to want me around now. I was licensed to survive. When I was a teenager, I used to think I'd rather die than grow old, I told Katie as she drove home from the UPS store. One of my heroes was a poet who pledged to kill himself when he turned 30. Now I'm obsessed with living as long as possible. I don't know what happened to me. Maybe, Katie said as she swerved onto Laurel Canyon Boulevard, narrowly missing a car making a right-hand turn. You just needed enough experience to show you that life is too beautiful to want it to end. Lesson 55. Secrets for Civilizing Lone Wolves. The call came at 4:48 p.m. "There's been a train accident," SR-77 said grimly. "We're staging at Rinaldi and Canoga in Chatsworth. I don't have any further information right now." "I'll be there in 20 minutes," I told her. I slipped into my uniform, pinned on my badge, loaded my tactical belt, grabbed my EMT jump kit, and raced to the car. As I neared the staging location, four policemen stood in front of yellow caution tape, stretched across Canoga Avenue. I showed my CEMP badge, and they let me through the roadblock, no questions asked. We'd already been involved in a number of incidents, most recently helping to capture a serial arsonist in Griffith Park. But this was the biggest disaster we'd been activated for since I joined. In fact, it was one of the biggest disasters in Los Angeles since I'd moved there 9 years earlier. In learning to run away from catastrophes, I'd somehow ended up running to them. A Metrolink commuter train carrying 222 passengers had collided headfirst with a Union Pacific freight train. Near the scene, I found the rest of the team amid a sea of police cars and fire trucks. Smoke billowed into the air while passengers wandered dazed and bloody in the street. Nearby, firemen waited impatiently for permission to cut through dead bodies to get to victims trapped beneath. Though the news had reported only 3 casualties so far, it was clear there were many more. Though I wanted to run to the train and help, this was the incident command system in action, and we had to wait for our assignment. In the system, either everyone is a hero or no one is. Individual initiative costs lives. "Who here is an EMT?" asked SR-7, our incident commander. He just received his instructions on the radio. I raised my fortunately fingerprinted hand, as did 5 other members of the team. "I need you to grab your medical bags and go to Chatsworth High School. We'll be staging there." We jumped wordlessly into my car and drove to the school, where we turned the auditorium into a reunification center for families and the gym into a treatment center. In the meantime, rescue workers from the Red Cross, the Office of Emergency Services, the police department, and the fire department began arriving. While the critically injured victims were transported to area hospitals, the walking wounded were sent to us. They trickled in with cuts, bruises, scrapes, and sprains. Around their necks hung the triage tags I'd learned about in CERT and EMT classes. I never thought I'd see them used in a real disaster so soon. As we worked, a van belonging to a computer repair company pulled up in front of the gym to distribute pallets of water. Local residents came by with boxes of donuts and thermoses of coffee. Pizza stands, supermarkets, and drugstores contributed food and supplies. The generosity from the community was staggering. It flew in the face of my Flysian beliefs. My first patient was a bald Hispanic man in a large button-down shirt and khaki pants. He limped toward my station and collapsed into the chair. After quickly checking his ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation, I knelt down and inspected his legs. As I did, I was overwhelmed by a sense of purpose. Prior to this moment, my life had been dominated by the pursuit of pleasure, personal growth, and survival. I never imagined I'd be doing something that was actually helpful to others, or that I'd find it so fulfilling. Me and some of the passengers wanted to go back in for the others, but the car was on fire, he said as I checked for fractures and deformities. He seemed to be replaying the scene in his head, trying to figure out if there was anything he could have done to help his fellow commuters. But we got scared. It was too dangerous. We tried, though. We really did. Unlike what the survivalists, the PTs, and Lord of the Flies had led me to believe, it seemed that tragedy also had the power to bring out the best in people. Not just the firefighters and police officers who worked around the clock. Not just the locals who arrived en masse to volunteer. Not just the businesses that brought truckloads of supplies for neither monetary nor marketing gain. But even the victims themselves try their best to help one another. They might have behaved differently if their lives were in danger, resources were scarce, and they had to compete to survive. But once they were safe, it seemed that people's first instinct was to look after one another and support their community. Maybe I needed to consider modifying my Flysian philosophy. If people were animals, then like most animals, they were essentially harmless most of the time, unless they felt threatened. That's when they became vicious. As we treated more survivors, cookies, granola bars, hamburgers, pizza, and energy drinks continued to arrive by the armful. When I thanked one woman for her generosity, she replied with a smile, "It's not looting if you leave a note." I looked up and recognized her from my CERT class. I guess I was no longer a lone wolf. When the trickle of survivors stopped, we were sent to the crash site to join the rest of the team. The riot of toppled, crushed, derailed, and accordion train cars was one of the most brutal things I'd ever seen. The Metrolink locomotive had been pushed back into the first passenger car, shearing through the metal to come to a stop more than midway through the carriage. The force of the impact had knocked the car off the tracks and onto its side, where it lay decimated. It seemed doubtful anyone in the front of the train had survived. Our task was to help light the scene so firemen could extricate the remaining bodies. On the ground outside the decimated car, a lone sneaker lay in a pool of diesel fuel. I wondered about the fate of its owner. Meanwhile, paramedics taped a yellow tarp over the back windows of an ambulance, preparing it to receive the body of a female police officer who'd been a passenger in the front car. I walked back to the second car, where I noticed a pile of bloody rags in the doorway. Beyond them, a man lay sprawled on the ground, partially covered with a sheet. It was the first dead body I'd seen in my life. His right hand was extended. Next to it, a cell phone lay flipped open, as if he'd been making a call, unaware it would be the last thing he ever did. It was my worst fear come to life. The torn metal, the shattered glass, the bodies ripped from life. This was what the world really looked like through apocalypse eyes. And it woke me up to something I'd spent the last 3 years trying to fight. My own powerlessness. In that moment, it felt like there was no other being out there, or up there, or anywhere, who cared about us. We're just fragile machines, programmed with a false sense of our own importance. And every now and then, the universe sends a reminder that we don't really matter to it, hurtling us into confusion and a panic for answers that will allow us to resume our program again. On the other side of the train, a blood-soaked white blanket lay over part of the body of the engineer. It looked as if he tried to jump out of the train at the last minute, only to be crushed by the engine as it toppled onto him. If he'd made it just 3 feet further, he would have lived. Perhaps survival, like success, is just a matter of talent, luck, and timing. Maybe that would be a more accurate motto for the survivalist boards than endure, adapt, overcome. Further back, up the side of the embankment, a large, lumpy yellow tarp lay spread across the dirt. As if to eliminate any doubt as to what it concealed, a cell phone began ringing from underneath. Now I knew how I responded when plunged into the fire. I didn't get physically sick. I got spiritually sick. A few minutes later, a team from the coroner's office arrived and began pulling back parts of the tarp. Bodies lay underneath in various stages of deformity. One man was eviscerated, his organs spilling onto the ground. A young man's leg was amputated beneath the knee, his face crushed beyond recognition. And a woman's bones were broken in so many places, she looked like a discarded marionette. They were all on their way somewhere. They all had unfinished business to take care of. And it didn't matter whether they were the good guys or the bad guys, honor students or struggling businessmen, faithful wives or cheating husbands, hardcore survivalists or frail snivelers. They were all dead, indiscriminately murdered by fate, if one can even believe in such a word after an accident like this. I followed the path of our floodlights further along the embankment to the side of the freight train. On the ground alongside it, I noticed a thick pool of red. It appeared to be the biggest bloodbath I'd seen yet, until I noticed blue vats nearby and realized they were all filled with strawberry preserves, which must have been part of the train's cargo. When I left the scene and returned to Chatsworth High, there were still families sitting outside the reunification center. They were waiting for their sons, their daughters, their fathers, their mothers to return. But I had just seen the loved ones they were waiting for, under yellow tarps and white sheets. My eyes misted with my first tears of the day when I saw the hope in their faces. There was no more hope. 25 people died in the crash that day, and 134 were injured. It was the worst train disaster in California history. I've been in the force for 21 years, and I've never seen anything like this, the captain of the Devonshire Police told us during a combination stress management session and award ceremony afterward. I want to thank you for all you did. If there wasn't a response like this, more people would have died. That night, I noticed that the change that had begun in EMT class had taken root. I no longer wanted to just get a CEMP uniform and a little stress inoculation and then run. I may have felt that way when I was taking the fire department's cert course. But now, as I lay in bed, instead of imagining how to escape the city and talk my way past barricades, I thought about what I would have done if I was the first person on the scene of the train crash and had to triage the victims until ambulances arrived. Whenever I heard the screech of car brakes outside my house, I tensed, ready to grab my EMT jump kit and run to the street if the sound of crushing steel and breaking glass followed. My first instinct was no longer to flee in the face of disaster. Instead, if that disaster posed no threat to me, my first instinct was to stick around and try to be of service. Somehow, since meeting Leonard Cohen, I'd accidentally completed my transformation from runner to fighter. And perhaps that made me a better survivalist, because my preparations were no longer just for my own continued existence, but for that of my community. After all, for those who look the awful truth in the eye and have the courage not to turn away, there's only one way to carry on with life. Be good to and look after each other. Because if we just give up, Leonard Cohen's fear comes true and the spirit dies. Lesson 56. How to tell which side God is on. I got my St. Kitts passport, Spencer informed me. He had flown into town, probably just to gloat. I guess this means you don't need to buy your own island anymore, I replied, though I secretly hoped he'd still get a submarine so I could ride in it. How'd you get yours before I got mine? It was 2 weeks after the Metrolink crash, and we were eating tacos on Sunset Boulevard. Spencer's Hamptons roommate Howard had recently fled the country after the mortgage company he helmed had collapsed, and Adam, the venture capitalist, was living in Austria. We were the last ones left. The developer came back to us with a modified agreement, so we were able to buy the house. He bit into a burrito the size of a baby's arm. Four women rose from the table next to us, leaving their food half-finished. And not a moment too soon. The day before, the government had seized Washington Mutual Bank. And in previous weeks, some of the country's biggest mortgage and brokerage firms had either gone bankrupt or been bailed out from the brink by the government, including Lehman Brothers, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and AIG. On top of everything, Tarasov and Associates, the company Spencer and I had used to protect our assets, was under investigation by the IRS. I hoped they'd remembered to protect their own assets. Everything Paul Kennedy had predicted in the rise and fall of the great powers seemed to be coming true. I was reminded of a story I'd once heard about two men wrestling. A spectator asks a wise man, "Whose side is God on?" The wise man replies, "God is on the side of the winner." "We lost an empire in 8 years," Spencer continued. Around us, billboards several stories tall advertised iPods, Calvin Klein bras, Seinfeld reruns, and, with the slogan, "Drive like there is a tomorrow," the Mini Cooper. "What I want to know is how that will trickle down to the average person," I replied. I wondered what future history books would say about us. Between the nuclear bombs we dropped in Japan, the massacres in Vietnam, the invasion of Iraq, and the attempts to politically and economically enslave less developed countries, it seemed likely that we'd go down in history as the bad guys. "Look at Mao's great leap forward," I continued. "As a consequence of bad policies, more than 20 million Chinese citizens died of starvation." "There are a lot of doomsday scenarios, but I don't think we're there yet," Spencer replied. "What we're seeing is the painful shock of the U.S. unwinding its heavy leverage." The traffic on Sunset Boulevard flew by. Wide black Hummers, boxy pink Mini Coopers, squat yellow Porsches. You'd never know from the surface that the country was sick. "The hope is that the world has a motivation not to let that happen, because we're their customer and they have a vested stake. Imagine losing 25% of your business. If America goes down, China and Russia and everyone else are going to be pulled down as well. And that's going to lead to a lot of turbulence and revolution. So are you prepared for a world crisis?" I asked him. "I feel like I am." Two men in button-down shirts with crosses and skulls on the back walked past, both talking on their cell phones. "As long as we have cell phone reception, as long as we're able to connect to the internet, as long as we can turn on the TV and see the same familiar faces, then we'll never truly believe anything is wrong. By the time we lose reception, it'll be too late." "We've done what no one else took the time to do," Spencer continued. "If things get to the point where it's really bad for us, it's an easy plane ride to safety. We may have to lose some money and rebuild somewhat, but we'll be fine. I'm calling Maxwell as soon as I get home," I pledged as we left. 2 weeks later, Maxwell emailed to let me know that my St. Kitts passport was waiting for me in his office. Finally, my backup plan was complete. I leapt up from the computer and told Katie the news. "What if he's lying?" Katie responded with her usual quick thinking. "We should go there and find out. St. Kitts is a small island. We can hunt him down and interrogate him and get your money back." "How will we do that?" "We'll hide around the corner from his office until he gets there. Then jump out and tell him he has to give you your money back or else." "Or else what?" "Or else we go to the police. And if they don't believe us, then we bribe them. Money talks, babe." Katie was right. to a point. I needed to get back to the island as soon as possible, to see if Maxwell had really come through. I thought about how much had changed since I'd first walked into his office. Back then, I was scared. Now, though the world had become an even scarier place, I wasn't motivated by fear. If there was a disaster in America, I wanted to be here for it. I wanted to stay and look after my neighbors and do recovery work with CEMP. Yet at the same time, I missed St. Kitts. I liked the people, the beaches, the climate, the cleanliness, the rum punch. It was the closest I'd been to paradise, and the few times I'd visited were happy and productive. Unlike America, which had let me down over the last 8 years, St. Kitts hadn't disappointed me yet. It was a new relationship. It was the Wild West with an ocean view. Before flying back to St. Kitts, I called Wendell Lawrence, who'd originally urged me to move there. I told him about the rescue work I'd been doing and asked if there was any way I could be of help to the island. He put me in touch with the National Emergency Management Agency, the St. Kitts equivalent of FEMA. And so, after waiting for what would be the last time in a St. Kitts tourist lane to clear immigration, I returned to the Caribbean, not just to take advantage of its citizenship program, but to be useful. Lesson 57. Things to do when you're a dual citizen. As soon as I touched Catician soil, I took a taxi straight to Market Street. So much time had passed since I'd last seen Maxwell that I made the mistake of trying to engage him in small talk. Any luck working less and golfing more? No. The word seemed laden by the weight of the world. Unlike you, I have to work all day, not just sunbathe and play tennis. I couldn't even remember the last time I'd played tennis. Maxwell started filling out the last of my paperwork. Every laborious action seemed like a message, letting me know that he'd rather be golfing. But this time, I didn't care. It didn't matter if he was happy, sad, friendly, mean, or illiterate. He'd done his job, and though he'd done it slowly, perhaps that was just the pace of life down here. As he handed me a manila envelope, my heart filled with a warm, expansive feeling that Greg from the Sovereign Society told me he'd felt after leaving New Zealand. It was as if a large white building had been lifted off my chest. I shook Maxwell's hand, thanked him, and then, in a careless burst of optimism, invited him to dinner to celebrate. "I'm exhausted," was his reply. I left the office, clutching the manila envelope, as if it were a newborn child I didn't want to drop. The street was dense with the sounds of soca, the smell of fresh-baked bread, the bustle of teenagers on their way to this or that street corner. I wanted to find someplace quiet to open the envelope, somewhere it wouldn't get snatched out of my hands. Nearby, the tight cluster of dilapidated buildings and cramped shops parted to reveal a cathedral. I walked down the street and entered the dark church. Aside from the attendant at the door, I was the only person there. I sat in a pew beneath an organ with pipes as thick as my torso, and, with Jesus staring down at me from the cross, I undid the clasp on the envelope. The first document I saw was a white piece of paper, which I pulled out to examine. The sight of the citizenship certificate took my breath away, especially when, beneath the thug-like photo I'd taken over a year ago, I read the words, "Citizen of St. Christopher and Nevis." I reached back into the envelope and grasped a thin booklet. A lump formed in my throat when I pulled it out. I opened it, my excitement building to a climax, Jesus craning his neck behind me. There it was, finally, my name and mugshot on a non-U.S. passport. Even secret agents had to forge their documents. This was legitimate. As Wendell had said, my future wife and children would be Catitians too. As I stared at it, I realized that a second citizenship was no longer something I needed, but something I wanted. Nationality mattered a lot less to me than it had 2 years earlier. I had survived just fine with a knife in the forest of America, and I'd survived just fine with a knife in the jungles of St. Kitts. just to make sure I could get by on the island without help from the outside world. I found a local nature expert named Chris, who helped me get to know the local plants and wildlife, which consisted mostly of monkeys and, ironically, goats. Though I worried I'd have buyer's remorse after such a long, costly journey to get such a little booklet, I was elated. I had a beautiful apartment on a beautiful beach in a beautiful country. I was an American. I was a Catitian. The world was that much more open to me. Keeping the passport as a backup in case of emergency didn't seem so paranoid anymore when 3 weeks later, during a terrorist attack in Mumbai, eyewitnesses reported that gunmen specifically asked for people with American and British passports. But more than that, I already had three immediate uses for it. First, I booked a trip to Cuba. Then, I called back the Swiss banks that had turned me down. They might not want to do business with Americans, but there was nothing wrong with doing business with Catitians. And finally, I took Spencer up on the advice he gave me when I first met him and started a publishing company, luring my first authors with an offer to work in my compound in St. Kitts. By compound, I meant my apartment with a stockpile of supplies. Unfortunately, the first author I signed died of heart failure before making it to the island. He did, however, live 6 years beyond the average American life expectancy. His name was Larry Harmon, but he was better known as Bozo the Clown, one of television's most popular children's characters. Even with the makeup off, he was the happiest person I'd ever met. His secret to longevity, he told me one night over dinner, his face glowing with enthusiasm, was just keep laughing. Along with my passport, guns, water, medical supplies, a loving family, a healthy diet, and exercise, I promised him I would add laughter to my survival stockpile. A good soldier is always prepared. Lesson 58. What to do when the lights go out. Nearly 500 Catitians stuffed themselves into Sugar's, a local bar and pool hall, to watch the 2008 U.S. election. Among them was a small smattering of foreigners, including Katie, Spencer, and myself. "I like it here," Katie chirped as someone handed her an Obama pin. "Everywhere you look, it's really lush and green. There are little monkeys, and the people are nice. I feel safe." I agreed. I'd come to trust her instincts. We had voted by mail, then flown to St. Kitts. Spencer was worried that if Barack Obama lost, there would be race riots at home. And though I didn't worry about unlikely events like that anymore, especially since I had a ham radio, a network, and experience to keep me informed and safe, it was a good excuse for my first trip to the island as a citizen. Judging by the enthusiasm at Sugar's, where Catitians wore Obama shirts and sang "Hey, hey, hey, goodbye" every time McCain lost a state, people would probably be just as angry here also. As CNN blared on a bass-heavy sound system more accustomed to soca and reggae music, I thought back to the election 4 years ago, when the idea of leaving the country first entered my mind, and I hoped that this time we would redeem ourselves in the eyes of the world and of history. As midnight neared and Obama's electoral votes began to surge, bartenders handed out plastic glasses and filled them with complimentary champagne. Then, suddenly, a sound like that of a record slowing down filled the bar. The television shut off, the lights flickered out, and the room went silent. Another blackout had struck. Fortunately, this time, I was prepared. I switched on a flashlight and found Spencer and Katie. "We can go watch the election back in my, compound. I have a generator." On the way home, we took a detour along the Caribbean, past the open-air beach bar, where I'd first made the decision to buy the apartment that would give me citizenship. We noticed it had a generator running and CNN blasting, so we decided to watch the results over rum punch on the beach. "If you're prepared and don't panic," I'd come to realize, "most of life's emergencies are merely inconveniences." When the 44th President of the United States was announced at midnight, and the crowd at the bar burst into applause, a wave of relief spread through the three of us. It felt as if we'd been holding our breath for 8 years, waiting to exhale. It's not that George Bush was a bad guy. There are no bad guys, just people who are bad at their jobs. In a way, I was even grateful to him. If it weren't for his administration, I wouldn't be in a second home on a moonlit Caribbean beach with a completely new outlook on life and my place in it. I just hope the changing of the guard in America wasn't too late, as the gaping hole at Ground Zero had been reminding us for the last 7 years. It's easy to tear something down. It's difficult to resurrect it. There's still hope for America after all, a celebrating petition in a bright red shirt proclaimed nearby. There was that dangerous word again, hope. I was reminded of the party in the White House on the night we safely entered the millennium, when we expected the best, but weren't prepared for the worst. This time around, not only was I prepared, but I learned that hope is a passive emotion. It's the last resort of the powerless. In the face of the unknown, I prefer action. That's why, when I'm not in St. Kitts, most days you'll find me in Los Angeles, doing search and rescue as SR-14 with CEMP, training with the Disaster Communications Service as ham radio operator Kilo India 6 Sierra Juliet Charlie, working local medical events as EMT number B1892201, running mass casualty incident drills with CERT Battalion 5, or milking goats in my backyard. Those who run from death, like the survivalist in their bunkers and the permaculturist in the forest, also run from life. As an EMT, as a CEMP member, as a latecomer to the world of outdoor adventure, I discovered that the opposite is also true. Those who run to death also run to life. When you walk to the very edge of the abyss, and you lean over and peer as deep into the blackness as you possibly can, and maybe you even lower a hand into it and pull someone out who's not supposed to be there, that's when you feel alive. I used to wonder if Kurt Saxon, Tom Brown, Bruce Clayton, and all the other survivalists I met ever regretted dedicating their lives to a skill set they never had to use. But now I know the answer. They use those skills every day. Because after 3 years of searching and learning and accumulating, I've learned that it isn't actually survival these skills bring. It's peace of mind. I now know that I can take care of myself and my loved ones. But until the day comes when I have to do that, I'm going to be taking care of everybody else. Epilogue. She was a 19-year-old student. She sang, played piano, and went to church every Sunday. Today, there was a CEMP call out to Northridge, where an SUV sped through a red light and hit her as she was crossing the street. Her body flew several dozen feet through the air before landing face first on the ground. The jewelry she was wearing clattered across the intersection. The artwork she was carrying scattered in the wind. She seemed talented. She seemed smart. She seemed generous. She never had a chance. It could have just as easily been me. It could have just as easily been you, but it was her. Tomorrow, though, is another day. The parting words of the fishwife Sidur to Gilgamesh. When the heavenly gods created human beings, they kept everlasting life for themselves and gave us death. So, Gilgamesh, accept your fate. Every day, wash your head, bathe your body, and wear clothes that are sparkling fresh. Fill your stomach with tasty food. Play, sing, dance, and be happy both day and night. Delight in the pleasures that your wife brings you, and cherish the little child who holds your hand. Make every day of your life a feast of rejoicing. This is the task that the gods have set before all human beings. This is the life you should seek, for this is the best life a mortal can hope to achieve. This recording was produced and directed by John Runette. It was recorded at the Media Staff by Jeremy Wesley. It was edited by Lance Neal.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.